he's doing anything but cover for Donald Trump. Supposedly in his campaign, Donald Trump was going to release the files. Lo and behold, he's learned more, and he will do anything to avoid accountability and truth telling. And I think that's the very same thing with Andrew Cuomo. And you asked earlier, who are his supporters? They're the very same supporters as Donald Trump's supporters. They have the same donor base. They have the same people in their ears, same pollsters going to the White House saying you should support Andrew Cuomo. It's been well documented, and that's because these people value their power above all else.
And Lindsay Boylan, former senior aide to the disgraced former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, who was forced to resign over charges of sexual harassment, now running for mayor of New York City. Boylan was the first of the 11 women to publicly accuse Cuomo of sexual harassment. That does it for our show. Juan Gonzalez will be speaking at Delaware Technical Community College in Georgetown, Delaware, tonight at 6 and tomorrow at 6 at the Delaware History Museum in Wilmington. I'll be speaking in Santa Fe after the showing of the film Steal the Story, Please at the Lensic Theater on Friday night, October 17th. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
I'm Sequoia Ezekwe for Ear to the Streets of Portland on the best community radio station on the planet, KBOO Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from 988 Oregon, a public service helping those who are feeling sad, struggling with alcohol or drug use, or just need someone to talk to. Trained counselors are able to listen and provide support 24/7. Confidential support available by text or phone call to 988. More info at 988oregon.org.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 8:02 a.m. Next up is PDX Progressive Talk Radio.
Circus, if you're seeking respect and attention, if you're in need of a gig that'll help you feel big, come with me and put some folks in detention. Just last week was kind of rough. I put a kid in cuffs and zip tied a woman to a van. We can sneak around town hunting working folks down. I hear they get a great benefit plan. Join ICE, boy, ain't it nice. Join ICE, take my advice. If you're lacking control and authority, come with me and hunt down minorities. Join ICE. Well, I failed the academy, the cops weren't having me, the army didn't sound that fun. So I found me a paramilitary operation that was keen to hand me a gun. See, I got picked on in school, I never felt that cool. There's a hole in my soul that just rages. All the women turned me down, they told me I was a clown. Well, won't you look at me now, I'm putting folks in cages. At ICE, they got great hours. Join ICE for respect and power. They got a sign-on bonus of 50 grand. They're in need of you needing to feel like a man. Join ICE. Join ICE.
For Portland, I had to. Good morning, Portland. I had to introduce you to Jesse Wells and join ICE. Many of you probably know of Jesse Wells. He hit the scene late last year, I think it was, formally with his folk music that reminded me of Bob Dylan. Anyway, good morning, Portland and beyond. Thank you for allowing PDX Progressive Talk Radio to fill your morning routine on Wednesday, October 15th, 2025. We're so happy to be able to bring you information you can only find on KBOO Community Radio at 90.7 FM in Portland or KBOO.FM everywhere. And we have an app too. So you can go into your Google store or your app store or whatever, wherever you get your apps, and type in Google or type in KBOO Community Radio and it should pop up, and the app works really well. And we could not do this, any of it, without the support of our members and donors. So thank you to all of you, considering the fact that we no longer get Corporation for Public Broadcasting funding, every cent counts. I have a little bit of a news breakdown, but we have a guest today, and I am so happy to have him here. This is not a new person. My audience has heard of him before, and many of you probably have supported him in the last election. We have Oregon House District 52 candidate Nick Walden Poblin.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Hi, Nick.
Hey, how are you?
Awesome. It's good to see you again.
Good to see you, too.
He is fabulous. I adore this man. You have no idea. And I am going to let him tell you why.
Well, my name is Nick Walden Poblin, and like Sherry said, I'm a candidate for House District 52, which is the Mount Hood region. It encompasses East Gresham, East Clackamas, all of Hood River, and then part of Wasco County in the Dalles. Gotta love the Dalles. And I am also by day a substitute teacher, going in there tackling all kinds of issues from kindergarten to high school. And I have a healthcare background. I'm on the board of directors for Healthcare for All Oregon, and am the chair of the Democratic Party of Oregon's Healthcare Caucus.
And you are a busy, busy person.
I have meetings most nights of the week.
Yeah. And he's actually very dedicated. I went to a Working Families Party course this past weekend. It was a two-day workshop. Lovely. Hey, you guys, Oregon Working Families Party, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, all of you who participated and organized and helped us learn more about field directing and campaign management and being a candidate. And Nick was there too. I ran into him.
Yeah, it was a great weekend.
Yeah. Now, are you supported by the Working Families Party?
Yes. In 2024, I was their nominee for House District 52. So the way it works, you can be nominated by multiple parties. So I was nominated by the Democratic Party, the Working Families Party, and the Independent Party.
Right on.
And then they have an actual application process you have to go through as a candidate that's actually due this week. So I was actually working on that last night.
Oh, dear. Yeah. Oh, dear. And then you put away time to come visit me.
Yes.
And I so appreciate that.
No, I'm happy to be here.
So I have to do a little bit of a news rundown. And some of what you're going to hear here is Portland's rationalization, the Portland Police Bureau's rationalization of being able to manage issues at ICE, at the ICE facility, and random 911 calls or emergencies. So on the 5th, on October 5th, the Pentagon announced that it was reassigning 200 California National Guard troops to Portland to support ICE, the federal facility, and property protection. Surprise, surprise. This came shortly after a federal judge blocked Trump's plan to federalize the Oregon National Guard and deploy them in Portland on the 6th over the weekend. Protests continued outside the ICE facility at the South Waterfront location. There were reports of tear gas used by federal agents and clashes with demonstrators, yet we, or the protesters, are the violent terrorists, right? The protests were framed around national discourse as part of Trump's narrative of the fact that Portland apparently is burning and war ravaged. And if you follow me on TikTok, I showed you a little bit of video over the weekend in downtown Portland, and I would argue that that very much goes against the premise of what the argument that Trump is making. On the 7th, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's Kristi Noem visited the ICE building in Portland. Local government officials and some city councilors began drafting a Protect Portland initiative, a resolution directed at how the city should respond administratively to federal agents' presence. The central tension has been over Trump's push to deploy National Guard troops and federal agents in Portland, ostensibly to protect ICE facilities and federal property. What about the protesters? State and city officials challenged this legality, and a federal judge granted a temporary restraining order, which is where we are now, blocking the deployment of Oregon's National Guard troops. The federal government responded by relocating troops from California instead. The legal fight escalated. The Ninth Circuit Court appeared to incline to lift the restraining order and reopening the potential for deployment. Let's hope that doesn't happen, because we still don't have a decision. On the 8th, the Portland Police Bureau reported an incident in which a suspect trying to evade arrest swam across the Willamette River to hide on Ross Island. I remember hearing about this. The person was later booked into jail. Meanwhile, tensions over the National Guard deployment continued in legal political arenas. On the 9th, Portland Police Bureau announced two arrests during the protests near the ICE facility at the South Waterfront location. According to local news timelines, federal officers also took three persons into custody in that area during the protest activity. And there's some speculation as to who those people were. Anyway, so this goes on and on. Most recently, protesters in Portland staged an emergency World Naked Bike Ride, typically held in the summer, and it rained on those poor people, mm-hmm. to protest against the National Guard deployments and the mobilization, or the militarization of the protests. Costumed and whimsical protest tactics, like inflatable frog suit. Johnny loves that. My husband, he loves that one.
Everyone loves the frog.
I want to be the frog. Continued to gain traction as a means to diffuse tension and challenge the aggressive imagery pushed by federal narratives. Protesters have increasingly leaned into humorous, absurd, and symbolic tactics, like the costumes, inflatable suits, and nude bike rides, to challenge the stark militarized narrative from federal actions. The use of these tactics seeks to reclaim visual narratives of Portland as resilient, creative, and not defined by conflict. So I imagine trying to be a substitute teacher in one of Donald Trump's childhood classrooms.
Oh, boy. I can't imagine.
I mean, he's like a five-year-old.
Well, yeah. I mean, he would fit right in to some of the classrooms.
Yeah. It's like, well, I can't do it this way. Well, I can do it this way. And then he's got Stephen Miller in his ear going, oh, we can do this and we can do that. And after I've done a lot of studying on Antifa, and I've just recently found out why they consider it an organization, because in 1932 it actually was initiated as an organization with little pilot projects, and they had, it was totally organized and everything, but it hasn't been that way in over 80 years at least.
Right. I like to ask people who is the leader of Antifa and how do we make contact?
Exactly. Yeah. I was going to say, dang, I haven't seen anybody come get me, right? But anyway, so we have Nick here. It's not about a lot of this right now. We want to help Nick get as much support as possible. I am on the Nick train, and he wouldn't even represent me. So thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So as you know, we have Nick Walden Poblin here. He is the Oregon's House Oregon State House District candidate for District 52. He's a lifelong Oregonian who's built a career around health advocacy, student support, and bridging rural-urban divides. He's a former student health advisor, survived a serious health crisis during his grad school experience, and now wants to bring his personal understanding to Salem. Nick is running to address some of Oregon's deepest challenges: affordable housing, equitable health care, and education that works for all communities. Good luck with that. Especially in the gorge and smaller towns in his district, because that's needed in these areas. So all, please join me in your cars clapping. Welcome, Nick. Let's start with what motivated you to run the first time and now.
Yeah. I actually sat up one night in the middle of the night at like 3 or 4 in the morning, woke my husband up and said, "Can you believe that I'm doing this in the middle of my last run?" And he said, "Yes. Now go back to sleep." And I asked him in the morning, "You know, you said yes so surely, you were so sure." And he said, "Honey, you've been doing things like this since I've known you." We've been together almost 25 years next month.
That's crazy. Congratulations.
I know, it is crazy. And he has watched me evolve over time. And I'm someone who has always raised my hand. Always. I'm the kid in the classroom who, when there's an awkward silence, tells the teacher the answer because I can't handle it. So I got in because I learned that when I stood up and spoke out and was doing the right thing, you're never standing by yourself. And I wanted to make the change in my local community that I wanted to see. And I wanted someone who had been, as far as healthcare goes, I wanted someone who had been on the table to be at the table, because it doesn't happen very often. And we have great representatives serving on the healthcare committee in Salem. But they're people who are providers. They're doctors, they're dentists, they're folks who have maybe never struggled as much to get healthcare or access to healthcare like I have, or like I've seen my community struggle.
And you have. You've been like at the forefront of dealing with healthcare issues just simply by your own, with your own illness.
My first week of grad school at PSU, I was really so focused on how I was going to my life was going to be about school and me, and I'd worked so hard to get to that point, and I didn't feel well a couple of months beforehand. I went in and found out that I had a tumor at the base of my brain.
Oh, wow.
And everything hormonally in my body had ceased to function. So I went to the university, and the health insurance they had was a packaged product that quite frankly, wasn't good enough. It wouldn't have allowed me to survive. And I said to the university administration, "What do I need to do in order to make this different?" And they said, "Well, you'd have to start an advisory board. You'd have to hold open forums. You'd have to do..." Well, I did every one of those things.
Good for you.
Yes. And within a number of months, we fired United Health Insurance and renegotiated health insurance on behalf of 28,000 students for the first time, and revolutionized the way that health insurance was delivered to the university.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And awesome. When it came time for me to graduate, the university said, "Wait a minute, we don't want you to leave." And so they made a title for me, a student health advisor and trans health advocate. And I stayed there for another 10 years working on making sure that insurance program stayed true. And then a student never had to come to us and say, "What do I have to do to get coverage for this?" And we said to them, "You have to start a board. You have to do this. You have to do that." No, we just handed them the paperwork and said, "Here's the insurance plan."
That's crazy.
Yeah.
You did so much good work.
Well,
You do so much good work. Thank you. You're still working today.
I still work on healthcare today. It's still something that I want to see. You know, we brag about the fact that 97% of Oregonians have health insurance, but my big concern is the number of Oregonians who have inadequate health insurance.
Yes.
Who have a piece of paper that doesn't do them any good when it comes time to get care, who have been lulled by a false sense of security by a plan that isn't going to really protect them when the going gets tough.
Well, no, you have to pay $4,000 to $8,000 before they cover anything.
Out-of-pocket maximums and all
when they were charged, when I was getting charged for insurance, I said, but wait, you take $200 a paycheck.
Yeah, that's just your premium.
Out of my check every month, and I still have to spend $4,000. No.
Yeah.
No, that's legalized theft. And no, you aren't doing that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And some people are buying into this like it's the greatest thing ever. And I'm like, no. I have actually had good insurance, and that is not it.
If you tell me these days, and I used to have students sometimes tell me this, I have good insurance. I love my insurance company. And I say, if you say you love your insurance company, you don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
You're not paying attention.
At all. At all. Pockets are deep.
Yes.
And they like to be filled. So what do you see as the most urgent issue facing families in District 52 today? And how would you address it in your first 6 months in office?
Okay. So we're in trouble as far as healthcare goes.
Mm-hmm.
The Medicaid cuts that are coming down the hill, 20% in Oregon, we expect.
That's crazy.
In my district, there are a lot of providers who are hanging on because of those Medicaid reimbursements. Mm-hmm. And when those are cut by 20%, they are going to go out of business and they're going to leave the area. They may even leave the state. I don't know where they're going to go, but they won't be in Hood River. They won't be in the Dalles. They're not going to be in Sandy, Oregon. So even if you're not on Medicaid, this is going to affect you, because if there are no providers to take your insurance is just as invaluable as anybody else's. And so my biggest concern is making sure that when we have to go make those Medicaid cuts, that we are doing it with the most knowledge, the most care, the most preciseness that we have to, you know. Here's how I would fix it. Here's what I would do. I would put together an organization of individuals or a office somehow of folks in Oregon who will help make sure that people don't fall off the Medicaid rolls, because the government is going to start making that very difficult. They're going to start going to monthly renewals, quarterly renewals, where you're having to provide all of your healthcare information or your financial information to make sure that you still qualify for Medicaid. And they know that there are a number of people, a certain percentage of the population, who will not be able to complete this paperwork and will therefore fall off of the rolls automatically, who still need the healthcare. Yeah. So what I would do, my first thing would be to say is, I can't fix the hole that has been blown in the budget by Trump's big, beautiful disaster. But what I can do is make sure that we fight back on the local level and make sure as few people fall off of that system as possible who need it, so that when we finally do get the funds back, we're not going back in and having to do cleanup of a situation where people have been dropped from Medicaid who seriously needed it.
Well, and that's a question. I think Congress deserves as much credit for what's coming as Trump.
Oh, yes.
And we need to make that seriously. You are running for House District 52 in Oregon. There are many seats coming up in the House and Senate at the federal level.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of those are Republican. We need to make some sort of messaging showing that those seats are up for re-election in these given states. I haven't done the tally yet.
Sure.
But in these given states, these seats, Republican seats, are up for re-election and should very much be pushed over to Dem or progressive.
Yes. And I know I've heard this multiple times in my life, and you all out there probably have heard this before too, but I think 2026 is the most consequential election we have
literally
had. And it's going to be really interesting because Trump is not on the ballot.
No.
So will his people continue to show up? Will they continue to come out when they have seen what his leadership has provided to them?
Right.
We have to respond. as Democrats. Yes. As a Democrat, I must respond. Someone said to me, I was actually half asleep on the couch the other night. My husband was watching the Civil War documentary by Ken Burns. It's really
Ken
great.
Ken Burns is
super
fabulous.
Great. I'm half asleep, and there's a story of a young boy who comes running back to a Union camp, and he's still running when he reaches the camp, and he gets through the camp, and he's still running on the other side. Someone says to him, "Boy, why are you running?" And he said, "Because I can't fly."
Yeah.
And I thought, I sat straight up out of my half asleep, and I said, "Wait a minute. That's why I'm running, because there's no other way to solve these problems. If I could fly, I would be flying, but I have to run. It keeps my sanity. It's my knowledge. It's how I know every day that I am getting out there and doing the most things that I can do for my community. If I weren't running for office, I think I'd be pacing like a trench in my house in the hardwood floors.
Probably. Yeah. Yeah. And you are tackling some really serious issues like housing. Housing availability continues to be a major concern statewide. What local solutions do you believe could make the biggest difference in House District 52?
It's a huge issue in 52. I mean, we have, the other thing is, not to go back to healthcare too much, but doctors, nurses, practitioners who want to move to the area, but they can't find houses.
Yeah.
And it's not even a matter of not having the money or the capital. They have that, but there are literally no houses. And I was talking to, I was checking out at Safeway in Hood River not that long ago, and my cashier told me that she'd driven from Gresham to work in Hood River. And that's crazy. But these towns need these jobs, and they need them to be filled. And I've talked to lots of local business leaders too who say, "I would like to expand, but I can't expand because my workforce has no place to live anywhere nearby." So how would I fix that? I think there's a lot of red tape that needs to be looked at and looked into, and a lot of regulations that need to be looked into. Now, there's a caveat to that. When we punch holes in the urban district boundaries, we must do so with clarity and making sure that when we're building low and medium income housing, we are actually producing low and medium income housing.
That's quality.
Yes.
That's not garbage.
That's not garbage. That's not a mini mansion that can't be afforded or that's too much.
Right.
There's got to be a happy medium somewhere in there where we can allow the urban growth boundary to be punched holes into for building purposes, to build houses in areas that we really need them in my district, without building mansions and building quality homes for people to move into that can fill that are going to take those jobs, that are going to help our community. It's everyone's business, from business folks to healthcare to education, to make sure teachers can move into the district. It affects everything across the board.
Well, and this next question goes to that, actually. How do you plan to make sure career and technical education programs get the same attention as college and for-profits?
I'm a huge proponent of community college and especially of technical schools. If you look at my family, I'm the oldest of five. I have the most education, and I probably make the least because my brothers were smarter and one of them did a technical education, got a technical education, and has never looked back. I think we need to highlight those kinds of stories and those kinds of situations where folks are able to be lifted up by the fact that they went to these technical schools. Not every student coming out of school, and I've learned this now that I'm teaching, is going to go to a four-year college, should go to a four-year college, has the means to go to a four-year college. We need to make sure that there are two-year options, three-year options, nine-month options in technical schools with unions involved, and that we are highlighting those programs and making sure that we're setting aside money for those programs.
Now, what I would like to add into that is I went to DeVry University and Argosy University for my MBA. Both of those were for-profit colleges because I didn't think I could get into a state college. Mm. So I went where they could do my assessments and set me on a track for success, right? I'm almost $200,000 in student loan debt, right? For project management and IT and project management and management MBA. Right?
Yeah.
I should be able to get work and I cannot. So I want the technical colleges, because DeVry could definitely be a technical college. While it does have, the only thing it's missing is the rah-rah of the college experience. So like the sports and stuff like this. Mm-hmm. DeVry's a fabulous school. And I've done nothing but praise them, because today I would not know the things I know mm-hmm. and have had the experiences that I had I not gone to DeVry and had I not been involved with the military in Washington. So kudos. But it shouldn't cost $80,000.
No.
My education should not have cost that much. It should have maybe cost, you know, $20,000
yeah.
max.
Yeah.
Right? Especially with the contracts that they have with the corporate elite in tech, mm-hmm. right? It should have not cost anywhere near what it did. So what would you suggest or institutions do to mitigate these cost issues?
I think they need to team up with business. I think when you see them teaming up with business, when you see institutions teaming up with businesses, create pipelines to careers, you're not only getting the investment of the business, but you're getting the pipeline for the student who has a career option headed right. out of the organization. As far as the state level, I would advocate for more funds for community colleges and more funds for technical schools. I actually have an interesting story. I went to my first term at the University of Oregon, was bowled over by the experience from being a small town kid. Even Eugene, Oregon was big to me.
Right.
And the school was gigantic. I went for one term. I did not go back a second term. I couldn't afford it. I didn't know yeah. what to do. And so I went to a community college and I just took one class. And then the next term I took two classes. And, you know, it kept going. And that led me to Portland State eventually and to my master's program, for which I am in great debt too. It led me in that direction, and it was just bit by bit, step by step. And I think I think that for-profit schools can be important allies in the
yeah.
in the bid to get people educated and prepared for the modern economy. And I think the more that we can team up with businesses and organizations outside of the schools themselves to create pipelines for students, but also to create scholarship opportunity and drive down the price of those degrees.
Yeah, yeah. Just like broadcasting school was like $10,000.
Yeah.
And that was in the 90s.
I would have loved to have gone to broadcast school.
Oh, it was so much fun. That's yeah. how I found KBOO.
Really?
Yeah, it was a blast. It was awesome. So I'm going to open up the phones
sure.
if people want to call and talk to Nick or tell us your experience down at ICE or at the ICE facility or whatever you want to talk about. The phone number here is 503-231-8187. I do have a lot more questions for Nick.
You can ask me about the education, too. I mean, I'm in the classroom every day all over the district. I really yeah. wanted to know more about educational policy.
So what would you change about the way Oregon funds its schools, especially smaller and rural districts?
I change a lot of things, but I would change the fundamental way that we fund education. I don't think it should be tied to your zip code and property taxes.
Agreed.
Because what happens is you end up with kids in smaller areas and more impoverished areas who really need the resources, who can't draw on them. And then you put them in situations where they're trying to get bonds and things like that on the ballots. And we know how hard that is, even here in Oregon,
yeah.
to get those things through.
Yeah, and not only get it on the ballot, but you actually campaign to yeah. have it voted in.
Yeah.
And that's what Malala did. For 2024, we had a ballot measure, it was a ballot measure to modernize the middle school
mm-hmm.
and we were getting text messages and phone calls and it was in the local Pioneer paper and everything, and the text messages and phone calls were asking questions about safety and class size and stuff like this. And I said my biggest concern is modernization. I want tech in the classroom.
Oh yeah.
I want all of the kids. I don't care. And you can complain that kids don't know how to do cursive. Granted, they should know how to do cursive. That should be a requirement, but so should understanding a Mac.
Two things. We are teaching cursive in some classrooms.
Yes.
Yeah, I actually was teaching cursive just the other day.
Yes.
So it's alive and I saw some students using it, and you don't see it often enough. So when you do see it, you're like, "Hey, wait. You just wrote in cursive."
Yeah.
And so that's a big deal, because I grew up cursive in the little two-room school that I went to. The other thing is technology is so different depending on the school that you're in. It should be across the board. There are some schools yeah. I go in who have this high-tech board on the wall. You punch in something and everything comes up. There are some schools where we're still using projectors and wet wipes on the, just crazy stuff that it's not what the kids need to be using. They need they need to know how to use a Mac, like you said.
Yeah, they need to know how to use Microsoft tools, Mac tools, Google. Mm-hmm. And during COVID, a lot of the kids were offered Chromebooks. Mm-hmm. And I have a Pixel, which is another version of a Chromebook. And I heard a lot of the parents complaining about the Chromebooks. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. I wonder if they were trained on them.
Probably not.
You know?
Or maybe not.
And so that's where a lot of consternation comes from voters and people in society, is they don't necessarily understand the subject that they're talking about. Mm-hmm. So it's bad.
Right.
So what would you do to dissuade that with different issues that you see in the school environment, especially K through 12? How can we as parents or parents all in as a community, as a village, learn more about the issues that they see in the schools?
Oh, sure. That's a good question. Volunteer.
Okay. And that's good, too. That's
schools
fun.
Need you. I just was listening to a teacher yesterday. She's trying to put together, she's getting some salmon eggs, and they're letting the kids see the salmon eggs hatch.
Nice.
And she was questioning the children, all of them, about whose parents might come in and help set up the aquarium. And she had to ask not 12 or 13 kids to try to find a parent that might come in and help set up. So, I mean, it ended up being someone's grandma, and that's great, because she had an aquarium at home, and she was a great substitute for parents. But there's these opportunities to come to the classroom. I've been on field trips with kids. Mm-hmm. I have parents come into the classroom and help me with just reading or just sitting in the room and just being present. It means a lot to your kid, but it means a lot to the other kids too, to be able to see and interact with adults that aren't necessarily their teacher. So I think volunteering is the best way. I didn't know exactly what happened in the classroom. My husband's a high school teacher. It still didn't inform me enough to know exactly what's happening in the classroom, which is why I wanted money too. I needed to make an income. But that's why I chose to do what I am doing now, is because I wanted to learn firsthand what I could from the educational experience without just talking about policy. And the one thing that I have to say that excites me the most, or that warms my heart the most, is that we talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion a lot. And, you know, they become dirty words, and I'm not afraid of any of those words. It's happening on our playgrounds. It's when these children meet each other and interact for the first time without the outside stuff from their parents and anybody else, where it just comes down to diversity, equity, and including each other. They're practicing it every day. It's when they get older that we teach them that those things aren't okay or good. I mean, it's very
natural.
Well,
it's the influences and the filters that they live that they view the world through.
Yeah.
Right? We have 7 filters that we view the world through.
Right.
Right? And some of it's culture, some of it's education, some of it's family and history, and what we learn in school.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I think that is awesome.
I see it every day. I see it in the way they interact with each other and the way they treat each other on the playground and that kind of education that's taking place in the district and in the area. And it really... On the days when I don't have a lot of hope, I swing my feet over the edge of the bed and know that I'm going to go work with a classroom of kids who are hopeful on every day. And that's worth more to me than the paycheck.
You really enjoy what you do.
I do.
And I see it in your face and when you talk about it.
I have a lot of fun.
We have a caller. Alisa?
Hi.
Yeah.
This is my first time calling.
Welcome.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm calling is because my experience of, like, what you are all talking about, from, like, student loan debt to Medicare, similar to me, I went to, like, a community college, then went to my state school, and still didn't know what to do. I'm, like, in, like, 30 grand debt for that, but I then started acupuncture school, and the whole loan system with that is, like, insane. Most of the schools nationwide of, like, the acupuncture schools have closed down in the last, like, 15 years, so, like, or 5 years, 20 schools have shut down because of the student loan program.
Wow.
Most of the acupuncturists are in, like, 400 grand debt and cannot pay that back, similarly to the insurance companies not being able to pay them enough to uphold their businesses. And I am in 80 grand debt for the school that I went to in San Diego, so... I moved here to Portland, Oregon to go to People of Community Acupuncture Tech Institute, which is $21,000 for 3 years, and you pay out of pocket. And yeah, so this is like a more accessible way for me to still give to the community through the Working Class Acupuncture Program. And I'm finding fulfillment within that, but there is like a way to give healthcare in a like sliding scale way here in Portland, but it's just all messed up. Like trying to just like give care.
We agree.
And find ways.
Did you have a question for Nick?
No. I mean, the question. I don't know what the question would be. It's just like, how do we compete to the insurance companies, and shut them down a little bit.
Thank you.
Being mobbed, they're the mob.
They are.
I think we look at organizations like Healthcare for All Oregon, and we take them out of the equation. And Oregon is leading the way nationally about having a single payer healthcare.
Yep.
Of course, insurance companies don't have a lot of good things to say about that. They wouldn't, because their role would be minimized, greatly minimized. But Oregon has a board that's actually currently looking at putting together a single payer healthcare plan that will be presented to the legislature in the next year and a half. Wow. And then it will be referred to voters, either by the legislature or directly to be referred to voters. We've already added in our constitution that we believe that healthcare is a human right in the Oregon Constitution. So this is kind of us putting our money where our mouth is as far as healthcare goes.
Yes.
The other thing that I would say too is that I think if you serve the community with your degree that you get, there ought to be for every profession a way to get loan forgiveness at some point. Because I worked at Portland State University for 10 years after I finished my master's, and that led to a great reduction in the amount of money that I owed, because I stayed for 10 years at a state institution. But there should be ways for doctors and practitioners like yourself to serve the community, provide that health care, and then we take away part of that debt or all of that debt at some point, so that you aren't being constantly bombarded by those payments and can focus on treating the people that you need to treat.
Yep. Agreed.
Yeah.
Thank you for calling.
Yeah. Have a good day.
You too. Thank you. You know, that's curious, because I worked with the military for 10 years as a civilian federal contractor in military education for Central Texas College and the Naval Postgraduate School. And when the loan things started coming around again, I said I thought there was some sort of plan out there for people who worked with the military. And they said, oh, were you enlisted or an officer? And I said, no, I was a contractor with educational facilities supporting the military. And they said, no, you have to
qualify.
Be right. You have to be a veteran. So we have another caller. Oh, Jeff. You'll like Jeff.
Oh, hi, Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
Good morning, Sherry. Thanks very much for taking my call. Thanks for this important program. Good morning, Nick, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Sounds as if you are more than qualified to represent the people of your district. I am not a resident of your district, and I apologize for that. There's nothing I can do
too.
About that.
I forgive you.
I from personal experience, I'd like to tell you that I went for 1 year to Washington University in St. Louis. And that was in 1980. And the cost then was $10,000 a year at a private institution of great merit known around the world. And things have changed just a little bit. But on the subject of both education and healthcare, or education and health, I'm concerned, Nick, that we have come through a period of time where a health crisis, even more than the stroke that I suffered in 1998, and the HIV that I carry with me, even more than those health crises that are personal, we had a health crisis in the way of the pandemic, and I call it pandemonium for a reason. The fact of the matter is that the nationwide children were pulled from schools, were taught at distance, et cetera, and so forth. And I'm wondering now if we are in a position that we can actually bring into the future educable children. I am deeply concerned about educable children. Mm. It starts at home, I know. And don't get me started on the cursive thing, because when I was in third grade, I was advanced to the fourth grade and came back to the third grade class, and everybody going, gasp, he's writing in cursive, which is dumb, but that's the way it was. And I'm wondering, does the educability of our children have an impact on the future generally? And thank you for noting that the health insurance industry is not health care.
Right.
It's not.
No, there's two different things that are going on.
Can we somehow actually find it in our hearts and in our family lives across this nation to bring to the future educable children?
I hope so.
Hope is not a strategy.
I know, hope is not a strategy. We need real concrete things. I think that our children have been dealt a tough blow by the pandemic, or the pandemonium, or whatever we want to call it. I see in them some differences than I would notice in other, than I think I notice in other children. I think the way that they interact sometimes is a little more different. They tend to be a little bit more reliant on online than some of my older students. They use hand sanitizer at amazing rates, because they've been brought up with hand sanitizer to the nth degree. So they put that on several times a day. But you know, I will tell you, there are children lagging. There are children who need our help. But there are also a lot of bright spots in those classrooms. And there are a lot of children who are going to be our future, that are going to be educable children, and who I think are really bright spots. I leave every day with hope, like I said. I know the hope is not something that we can grasp or see or use to help, but I see these children where they are, and many of them are doing just fine. We have some work to do. There are sometimes when I am in classrooms with large numbers of children that there are multiple children who need direct aid. I worry about the federal healthcare cuts federal cuts to education that are coming down the pike to special education. Corbett, which is a school in my district, just found out that they were losing a majority of their school counselors because a grant that they wrote had featured DEI in it, and so it was voided out by the federal government, wiping out a majority of their counselors. These students need the resources. This is not the time to be taking away things from the classroom. We need to be adding on and stepping up.
Yes.
Well, I think I could walk away from this phone call being a little bit less depressed.
Good.
And that's a good thing. And oh, quickly, by the way, the comment, Nick, about watching the Civil War with by Ken Burns with your husband on the sofa, you falling asleep until you saw the child running clean through the camp.
He's been listening.
And he was asked, why are you running? Because yeah. I can't fly. The motto of our great state is, she flies with her own wing.
Yep, you're right. That's great.
And I hope you have a great day, and I wish you the best of luck in your run.
Thank you, Sherry. So much.
Thanks, Jeff. Make it a great day. So I have a question for you.
Sure.
How are you connecting with younger or first-time voters in District 52?
Yeah. So one of the things that we are doing is working really hard through social media, trying to meet young voters where they are. I have been getting on TikTok and Blue Sky and have been seeing, I don't know if you've been seeing this, but huge jumps in my social media following since Trump has tried to get his fingers in Portland.
Well, you're more active this time too.
Yes,
you're
more active this time.
More active.
Reaching out to people, being more active.
Yeah.
Working with the Latino network and in Hood River and the Dalles specifically to call out to younger voters, to reach out to younger voters. We know that we do things like radio and billboards and things like that, but that's not really a way to reach younger voters.
No.
One of the ways that we're going to be much more aggressive this time around is door knocking, meeting people at their doors. I didn't start door knocking till later in the season because I didn't have a primary opponent in the last election. I don't know if I will have one this time or not.
Still got to do it.
But still got to get out there, knock on those doors. It's good for me. It's good for them. It's good for everybody because I learn about those issues and get the talking points down and meet people where they are. And they are amazed that someone has come to their front door to have a conversation with them about their vote. And people really appreciate it. I did not think I was going to like knocking on doors. It's a really rewarding experience.
I'm so excited for that too, because I was a little off put at first that they used that the curriculum we went through this last weekend used comms and social media as a bottom with email as far as your campaign priorities are concerned. But after they explained, and I've spoken with you and I've done it too, knocking on doors, yes, you can build a community and you can build networks across social media and your own owned audience through email. But there is nothing that beats knocking on doors and really engaging with people. Even phone calls. I prefer phone calls, but that's just me.
I prefer phone calls to people that I know. I don't like cold. I'm not a big fan of, my campaign manager will tell you, I'm not a big fan of cold calling people that I don't know.
I'm getting better at it. That's challenging. That is. So we have another caller, it looks like. Oh, Santiago. Hello, Santiago.
Good morning.
Hi. How are you
today? Thank you for having me. I'm doing all right. You know, just another beautiful day in a war-torn Portland. You know, so I guess one of my, first of all, I want to say, you know, good luck running for this thing. It sounds like you got some pretty good ideas there, brother. I guess one of the things that I want to ask you about is, like, do you, when you're talking about education, my first question is, do you see the connection between because people think that, like, things have just gotten more expensive for no reason, like inflation or whatever. But understand that the real reason is because, you know, there is a cohort of people who don't want people to be educated. I mean, I'm not saying that everybody needs to go to a 4-year college. I think everybody has, you know, different skill sets that they should be able to employ. But on the topic of education in particular, we have a neoliberal system that sees educated working people as a threat. And so by that measure, they have tried as hard as possible to make education unattainable. And does that factor into your connections in terms of how you approach making education more affordable to people?
Oh, that's a really good question.
It is.
I have watched while there has been a great vilification against people with educational backgrounds. And I watched this with quite a bit of distress. I'm not super educated myself. I mean, I have 2 degrees, but this whole idea of being woke and what woke means, and I always push back on people. I'm like, can you define the word for me? And they never can.
Right.
And who is leading this woke thing? And they don't know what it means or who it is. It's this certain amount of willful ignorance I struggle with to a great degree. But yes, I do see this push against education, or this idea that you get through college and by plugging your ears and run through as fast as you can. And I think that's doing a major disservice to the folks, to the students who are doing that or in that situation, because college was for me a chance to really grow, learn, and become the person that I am. And I wouldn't be sitting in this seat having this conversation if I hadn't gone to the colleges and universities that I attended. And I think the pushback against education is just really got to change, got to be different. And I think part of it has to do with the way that we communicate with certain portions of our population. And education can't be used as a cudgel. We know that. You can't use it against people, but it needs to be seen as something that is part of the enrichment of our society and not something that's to do with the downfall.
Well, and I'm going to add to that a little bit, because I hear the only people who say that no one needs a college degree, it's just a piece of paper, are people who have never gone to college.
Right.
And yes, to some extent, college is a racket in different institutions because of their partnerships with conglomerates that don't actually care about the students. And it is a racket in many in many institutions, but in for those of us who sought out the education and dedicated ourselves to graduating and to making what we learned part of our lives for the rest of our lives, I want to say that by all means, college is not only needed, but it should be required to some extent. And it doesn't have to be a four-year degree. It can be a two-year tech college. It can be anything that expands your horizons and elevates your level of intelligence. Not that going to college actually makes you smarter, but it makes you think more, right? Is not a bad thing.
No, I don't think college is a bad thing by any stretch of the imagination, but I think it's important to understand that education was made a racket. Education isn't a racket, that it was made a racket for the specific purpose of being able to cut out large swaths of people from the working class from being educated, because we saw during, like, you know, it was really a backlash against the Vietnam War protests, because so much of the opposition was coming from people who were understanding America's place in the world,
right,
and how it actually functions as an imperial power, and not believing it, because it really just comes back to being of reinforcing mythology, and the mythology of America is very present whether you're talking about, you know, Democrats or Republicans, you know, because a lot of them don't want to admit the imperial nature of the United States as it has always existed. But I think, it's been made a racket, because people want to have that distrust. And I think it's just really important to point that out, that, you know, it's education hasn't just gone down simply because it hasn't been valued. It's been purposely devalued.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of that has to do with people not wanting others who are lowly, poor, working class people to be educated.
Or mobile.
And if we could get more public funding into higher education, I wonder if it wouldn't be less expensive like it used to be. Because at one time, someone could work part-time, go to school, get their degrees while living on their own.
Well, there's just no way that a state college should be that expensive.
As expensive as they are.
I know that I mean, not that you're not getting value out of the situation, but there's no way that the expense meets the value.
Right. And it's at the higher end, right? They keep wanting to blame the teachers' union for the cost of education.
I don't think that's where it's going.
That is definitely not where it's going.
Yeah.
And what can we do to find out where that money is going? Is that, like, EDMC had to file bankruptcy. EDMC was the owner of the Seattle Art Institute, Argosy University. And there were other art institutes all over the nation that EDMC owned. And they ended up having to file bankruptcy because they lost a lawsuit stating that they were, and having gone through Argosy, which is an EDMC school, I did not experience this, but others have stated, as they have some with DeVry and for other reasons, that they did not receive the quality of education that they were promised.
Okay.
And so that is a very big concern, especially for the for-profit institutions.
Sure.
But it seemed to me, as more expensive as the for-profit institutions became, the state institutions started raising tuition.
Well, I think what happened in Oregon is that the amount of funding that came from the state just diminished over time.
Yeah. And so, it has since the 90s.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember when I moved to Seattle in 94, that Governor Locke was having to make an announcement to the people of Washington that the education budget had been cut by like 25%.
Wow.
And all of the schools were going to see deep budget cuts. And I thought, you know, how incredible this is happening. They're taking money away from our kids.
Mm-hmm.
Not only on food, but on something that they'll need. Like, because kids, school education feeds the minds of our future leaders.
Absolutely.
And our future workers.
Absolutely.
Everything from plumbers to Microsoft engineers or Apple or whatever.
And I don't.
Why would you cut that funding?
Yeah, I don't get this right wing, quite frankly, push to end free lunches and take away aspects of the kids' child, you know, of their education throughout the day and special education and removing these resources.
Yeah.
From
to give tax breaks to the wealthy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? And that's what they've been doing these entire past 30, 40 years,
yeah.
is taking away from education, from people with needs, to give it to the real welfare queens that want to steal from us. They want to use all of the resources that the United States and the taxpayers provide for free.
Yeah, while not paying taxes themselves.
That's the point.
Yeah.
And what service are they providing?
Yeah, I don't know.
Because I don't see it.
Yeah, I don't know.
Right?
I mean,
and now they're strangling our food producers.
Yeah. We used to, I mean, I just saw this meme yesterday about how I missed the age where the wealthy actually built things for the public.
Yeah.
And we don't do that anymore. The wealthy don't build things for the public.
Suck everything up.
And become wealthier and wealthier, yeah.
Yeah, they really provide no actual benefit.
Mm.
We're running up on the end of the show. Well, Nick, thank you for being here.
Oh,
thank you for being
here.
My guest and my friend, and I really appreciate you and everything that you're doing. In all of the hardships and distractions we're being met with on a daily basis, please keep this in your heart. A positive mind, positive vibe, and positive life.
Mm.
Right? So whatever you can do. KBOO is a great place for finding content that really offers positivity and uplifting for your heart and soul. Hey, Ty, do you have some music? I want to thank Ty for being my engineer. And he's going to turn on some music. Make it a great day, and thank you for listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM and PDX Progressive Talk Radio. Thank you.
Yeah, and a picture. I'm going to get a picture of myself.
Rolling sea, when Jesus speak to Jonah. Rolling sea, when he rolled. Rolling sea, when Jesus speak to me. Rolling sea when it rolls. Rolling sea when Jesus speaks to Jonah.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the Artist Mentorship Program presenting the AMP Music Festival, a 3-day